Hello, and welcome to your most obedient and humble servant. This is Women's History Podcast, where we feature 18th and early 19th century women's letters that don't get as much attention as we think they should. I'm your host, Catherine Garrod. This episode is part of our season on wit. I had the pleasure of meeting today's guest at a conference for the Association of Documentary Editors. Riley Sutherland is this year's winner of the Sharon Ritenour Stevens Prize in Documentary Editing. Riley gave a really great presentation making use of a Revolutionary War widow's pension files. So we're going a little bit different. It's not a letter that we're working with today. It's a pension file, but it's fascinating. Riley is a PhD student at Harvard University with an interest in women's history, archives, memory, and state building. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Riley.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit about these sources. So these are pension files, which you've been using for your research. What are they? Tell me a little more about them.
Absolutely. So pension files are surprisingly rich for finding the voices of women who couldn't write their own stories down because they didn't know how to write. There are about 80,000 of them in the National Archives, and each pension file can be anything from a few pages to a few hundred pages. So some of these are really robust. And a pension file was created when a Revolutionary War veteran or a veteran's widow asked the War Department for a pension for their service. So veterans could start claiming pensions in 1818 if they could prove that they were indigent and they needed support. In 1836, Congress started allowing widows, even if they weren't widows of officers, to apply for pensions as well, only if they had been married before their husband's term of service had ended. So there was a limitation on it, and that kept getting more and more expansive as time went on with subsequent acts. So a widow would appear before a local court, a court of common pleas, or a court of probate, and she would give her story to a justice. The justice would ask her specific questions like, what is your name? Where are you from? When did your husband enlist? And when did you get married? And she would answer him as a clerk wrote everything down. So the pension file contains that testimony. It's a really neat, almost kind of oral autobiography that these women would create for themselves. Sometimes they also contain other forms of evidence. So the War Department really liked to see documentary proof to back up these women's oral claims. They would ask for marriage certificates, for written discharges for women's veteran husbands. But a lot of times women didn't have those records. One woman I study burned her marriage license because her husband left her after the war. Sometimes marriage licenses or discharge records burned in house fires. And as we'll learn about Phyllis here in a little bit, she couldn't present that evidence because her enslaver's grandsons actually burned her husband's discharge papers. Sometimes we see that evidence in pension files as well, but when widows like Phyllis didn't have that written evidence, they would go to their neighbors, family members, former officers, and they would bring them to court and ask them to also give oral stories explaining how they knew the widow and backing the widow up, explaining that their memories also correspond to the widow's. So in Phyllis's pension file, we can see lots of neighbors testifying to support her as well. So her entire file is 127 pages long and compiled over several years as she just kept gathering more evidence to back up her claim.
That's incredible. It's so interesting to me how much of the history of the American Revolution is just them trying not to pay people who fought in the American Revolution. What year did you say it was that women started qualifying for pensions?
Officers' widows qualified a little bit earlier, but for rank and file men's widows, it was 1836. So it was quite a ways after the war. Before that point, if a veteran died, so say when Cuff, Phyllis's husband, died, she would be able to claim the pension due to him at the time of his death, but nothing after that until 1836.
Oh my gosh. I know they did this for like everyone, but it's like we have to make sure that a man who owns land can come in and speak for them, because otherwise we can't trust this person. We've talked a little bit, this is a document from an enslaved woman, and so I'm sure that she had even more pressure to sort of bring people in who could back up her story and be sort of treated with suspicion. And I think that comes through even in the document itself. I was reading your bio as I was getting ready to work on this. You mentioned that you focused on Continental Army women as labor agitators. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, this is something I didn't expect to find, but I initially got into this research as a high school student. We did National History Day in school, which is like a science fair, but for history. And I read Carol Burkin's Revolutionary Mothers, and she talks about women who worked for the Continental Army as laundresses for soldiers, as nurses, and they traveled with the Continental Army. And I became really interested in these women, and I wanted to learn more about them, especially how did the war impact them? Because I was imagining if these women were living in camps, they were traveling with the army, certainly that had to have changed the way they saw themselves. And I was sitting later on in an undergraduate history course, and our textbook said that the war did not change these women at all because they were still performing domestic tasks. They were washing clothes, they were cooking, and I became very frustrated with this history textbook. So I started diving into records like orderly books, which are, as Ellen Clark at the Society of Cincinnati describes them, they're like the diaries of regiments, where an officer of a regiment will write down daily happenings. And in these orderly books, I started to see interesting relationships between generals and women. For instance, Anthony Wayne, who's a military officer, wrote that he became very frustrated with women who washed for his regiment because they refused to work any longer. They'd been washing men's uniforms, returning them to men, and then the men just didn't pay them anything. So finally, they refused to keep washing clothes. And Anthony Wayne wrote, these women were not, quote, given victuals to distress and render the men unfit for duty, but to keep them clean and decent. So he threatened to kick all of them out of camp. But of course, he couldn't do that because he needed somebody to wash their uniforms. If he didn't, then they were going to be full of lice, which spread disease. So he ended up withholding pay from men who didn't compensate the women for their work. So in this case, their strike was very effective. We also see nurses striking in a hospital in Pennsylvania. And the doctor who headed up that hospital wrote Congress frantically saying, the entire hospital is immobilized. I don't know what to do. Please send me money to pay these women. So I became really interested in the way women who didn't know each other before the war, right? They were accompanying their husbands to these regiments, were able to forge relationships with each other and then successfully leverage that collective power over military officers. In some instances, even George Washington. There was a group of army women in New York. And they found out Washington had been given orders to reduce the amount of rations reserved for women accompanying the troops because he was already short on food. And women, especially pregnant women, were consuming a lot of rations. They were figuring, well, women particularly who are pregnant are going to eventually need double rations because their children are going to need rations as well. So at one point, Washington ordered his officers remove all pregnant women from the ranks. But at this point, when New York women get word that they might be reduced, the wives of artillery men, they warned Washington that he was going to face consequences if he reduced their rations, and eventually their husbands threatened to desert if he did it. So he had to defy Congress and say, I cannot possibly reduce their rations. This is sort of the labor agitation or the collective agitation that I was looking at as evidence that women's participation in the war did give them an opportunity to forge networks with each other that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise, and it made them more aware of the essential nature of their work in ways that made them willing to advocate for themselves in this military and political context.
That is so fascinating. I'm actually not familiar with that George Washington story, but I love the idea of him being like, no, we're not feeding the pregnant women. Like, what? What, George? But you don't really think about, I mean, you hear about camp followers or whatever, but yeah, that is an essential service. Who's washing these clothes and who are the people doing nursing? And I imagine there was some sex work and all sorts of things.
Absolutely.
That is just such a fascinating story. And it's something that when you're looking with my work previously was the papers of Martha Washington, that doesn't come up quite so much when you're reading about the fancy officers' wives who are like having parties and dancing in the war tents. So this is just such a cool perspective that you don't hear a lot of. So I think it's just fabulous that you're working with these documents. we've sort of hinted at who we're talking about, but can you introduce me to Phyllis, who we're talking about today?
Absolutely. So Phyllis is from Guinea. She's from West Africa and is brought to Connecticut and enslaved as a young girl. She is enslaved by people named Charles and Elizabeth Hinckley. So she herself is referred to initially in records as Phyllis Hinckley. But she begins courting this man who is also enslaved by the Hinckley's coof. I'm trying to establish whether he was leased or sold, but he became enslaved by a local deacon, Israel Wells. And from there, he was leased to an apothecary. And he was responsible actually for preparing medications for people. So he gained a lot of knowledge as he was working as an apothecary. Phyllis, this whole time, was trying to get permission to marry Cuff, but her enslaver, Elizabeth Hinckley, was denying it. She would not let these two get married. Eventually, you know, the Revolutionary War breaks out, and Cuff decides to enlist in the Continental Army in exchange for his freedom. At this point, he and Phyllis make a pact that they are going to marry each other as soon as possible, during or by the end of the war. And Cuff continues to go to the Hinckley's estate in New London, Connecticut, to visit Phyllis. On one of those visits, Phyllis became pregnant, and she decided to use that, as well as her husband's service, sort of as leverage to finally convince Elizabeth to let her marry Cuff. They get married, and this is about the time Cuff in service. They get married in May of 1783. Cuff uses his payment to purchase 3 acres of land nearby in Connecticut, and he and Phyllis live there together and farm that land independently together for about 5 years, which is when Cuff dies of influenza. So Phyllis eventually remarries to another man named Anthony Tatton. He continues to live in that house with Phyllis that Cuff had purchased with her, his Revolutionary War earnings. They continue to farm it until Anthony himself dies. And in 1837, so shortly after this Pension Act is passed, Phyllis decides she wants to apply for Cuff's Revolutionary War pension. She's pretty poor at this point. She's living with the help of her son, also named Anthony, but she wants a way to supplement that assistance. She wants a way to start bringing in additional money and decides she's going to apply for his pension. So in the document we have today, Phyllis is appearing in court on November 3rd, 1837. In one of her first depositions, asking for that pension.
With that excellent introduction, let's dive into the document.
State of Connecticut, County of New London, in Colchester, 3rd November 1837. On this third day of November 1837, personally appeared before the County of Probate, Phyllis Tatton, a resident of Lebanon in the County of New London and State of Connecticut, aged about 85 years, not knowing her exact age, as she was brought from Guinea when a child, who being first duly sworn according to law, doth on her oath make the following declaration. She was married to Cuff Saunders, alias Cuff Wells, who was commonly called Dr. Cuff, who was a slave of Israel Wells of South Colchester, and that in order to obtain his freedom, enlisted into the Army of the United States in the winter of 1777 as a private soldier for the term of during the war, and was placed in a regiment commanded by Colonel John Durkee and Benjamin Troop, who was a brother to my old mistress, Mrs. Elizabeth Hinckley. Was first a captain, then a major in said regiment, when he did duty as a private army waiter to the surgeon of said regiment, and it having been discovered by the officers of said regiment that the said Cuff possessed considerable medical skill by having some years before been a slave of Dr. Langrell of Hartford, who is a physician and kept an apothecary store, where the said Cuff learned the act of preparing and mixing medicine, he was accordingly placed in the hospital as a waiter and assistant to the surgeon, and part of the time he acted as an assistant to the apothecary store belonging to the Continental Army at Danbury in the said state, where he continued till late fall of 1783. That we had agreed to marry each other before he went into the army, that he returned home in the month of May 1783 on a furlough, dressed in his uniform with red facings and the letters USA on his buttons, at which time she further declares that she was married to the said Cuff Saunders, alias Cuff Wells, who was commonly called Dr. Cuff, in the month of May 1783 at the house of my master Charles Hinckley in Goshen in said Lebanon by the Reverend Timothy Stone, deceased, then minister over the said Society of Goshen, and that the said Cuff soon after returned to the army at said Danbury, where he continued until late in the fall 1783. That he returned home, purchased about 3 acres of land, built a small house in said Lebanon near the line of Colchester, where we lived together until December 1788. And that her husband, the aforesaid Cuff Saunders, alias Cuff Wells, died in the month of December 1788 after a severe sickness with the influenza. Dr. Coleman died a number of years since, likewise belonged to the Continental Army, and lived a neighbor, attended my said husband as a physician in his late sickness. And she further declares that she has no documentary evidence, except the certificate from the state comptroller as to his service as a soldier, and the certificate of the Reverend Mr. Otis and Peleg Thomas, Esquire, of both her marriages, and that she at present knows of no person who can testify as to the said Cuff remaining in service, except Dr. John R. Wastrus and Miss Eleanor Hewitt. Signed with her mark, Phyllis Tatton.
Beautiful. Excellent. Thank you. One of the things that I noticed the first time I was reading this is that it sort of switches to somebody saying she and then I. And I think you sort of explained that at the beginning, that this is somebody writing notes, right, as she's giving testimony. Do you think it's the clerk is sort of sometimes writing exactly what she says and then sometimes trying to sort of translate it? Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding. And you make a really important point by noticing that change between the third and first person. We have to face the question, which is difficult, to what extent is Phyllis's voice in this document? And it's something I've had a lot of professors and other researchers ask me, how do you know the clerk is really representing her voice in this document? And it's something tough that we have to grapple with, especially because the individuals who are writing these are constantly trying to assess the veracity of her claims. So they're always making judgments of her character. But I think in those moments where we can hear him switch, we lived in a house together, we were married, the clerk was sort of getting interested and really drawn into this testimony and did start recording it as closely as he could to her words in those spots, which is really fascinating.
Yeah. To get that close to the actual spoken words of an enslaved woman at this time is so cool, because that's so difficult to get to, particularly since she never learned to read and write. It mentions that she wrote her mark instead of signing it. So that's just so cool. Incredibly cool document. I was so excited when you sent this to me. I just also wanted to ask, so we've talked about Cuff. Do you have any idea what's going on with his Cuff Saunders, alias Cuff Wells, who is commonly called Dr. Cuff, as his full title is, according to this document? Do you know what that is?
Yeah, so they just keep repeating all of these names over and over. The Cuff Wells is what he would have been known as when he went into the army. Wells coming from the name of his enslaver, Israel Wells, who was a deacon. And Cuff is, it comes from the Akan Kofi, meaning born on Friday. So this is pointing back to his experiences, his childhood in Africa, in West Africa, maybe from near where Phyllis was from as well. And then we have the Wells as a marker of his enslavement. Right before he marries Phyllis in 1783, the men in his regiment report that he starts going by Cuff Saunders instead. He decides to call himself that now that he's free. I've tried to figure out where the Saunders comes from, and I have not been able to piece that together at this point. But his child also ends up taking this name Saunders, as does Phyllis. So her file is under Phyllis Hinckley Saunders Tatton, the Tatton coming from her other marriage.
That's so fascinating. First off, I never put together that the name that white people would write down as Cuffy was probably Kofi, and that just blew my mind a little bit. But it makes it hard to study people when people's names change all the time, but it happens all the time, particularly with enslaved people who are sort of being given their enslavers' names. People are often very eager to change that a lot of times. So that follows. That makes perfect sense.
And it was difficult for Phyllis because, as you mentioned too, the names were changing all the time. she had to provide documentary evidence of his pay, of his service. And along the whole way, she had to prove that Cuff Wells really was the same person as Cuff Saunders, who was the same person as Dr. Cuff. And that becomes really difficult for her to the point where she actually had to summon former army surgeons and officers to appear in court and testify that he really did go by all of these different names, which is an added complication she faced that a white widow often did not struggle with, unless she had married a soldier who was, say, French, in which case she had to explain different naming practices or customs.
That is very interesting. And this is like so common, right? Women get married and change their names, then somebody dies and then remarried so they get more names. But it seems like that just blows bureaucrats' minds. Like, it's impossible that people just act like this is so insane from a modern historian perspective, even just digitally searching for people when you don't know if she'd be classified under Mrs. Cuff Saunders, alias Cuff Wells, who was called Dr. Cuff. Like, how would you find Phyllis? This time when you read it, it just sort of struck me where she mentions every once in a while she'll go into a little bit of detail. And so knowing sort of how the scene was going, I imagine one of the people that she's talking to, magistrates, asked her to add some detail, name a name or something. She mentions when he comes back from the war, he's wearing his red uniform that has USA on the buttons, right? So that is such an interesting little fact that A, she remembers a detail like that, and that B, that can help them time, like, okay, when were people wearing uniforms like this to a certain time frame?
Yes. And it also helps her establish her claim with other people she's having testify. So Eleanor Hewitt is somebody she mentions there. Eleanor lived nearby Phyllis and actually attended Phyllis's wedding because Phyllis's enslavers, or at this point, almost her former enslavers, invited their neighbors to Phyllis and Cuff's wedding, which is something that surprised me as I was reading these documents. But Eleanor likewise says, I can prove that I was at Cuff's wedding because he was in his military uniform and I can describe it. And her description of his uniform is almost identical to Phyllis's, which made me wonder, did they communicate about this before they both testified? Is this something they were trying to use? Because widows and the people they brought with them, we often have evidence would sit and they would discuss it. There's even one son who was trying to help his mother get a pension, and he wrote, after he was rejected, asking for a list of every person who succeeded in the state of Connecticut so he could communicate with them to learn what they did and try to replicate it. So those little details are really helpful pegs, and they also make it difficult because they need to be replicated through so many different testimonies to prevent discrepancies that would undermine the claim.
For a war that ended 50 years ago, right?
Yes.
You can misremember when somebody came home wearing the cool outfit so easily. And also fascinating that her enslavers were like, no, you can't get married. No, you can't get married. But when you do get married, we're going to make it a party. Obviously, there's a ton to dig into. There's so much. But I feel like everything about this story sort of challenges a lot of preconceived notions about what life in the Continental Army was like. Did you agree? Did it affect the way that you saw military life in the Continental Army?
It really did, in multiple ways. I think the first of which is just by challenging me to see how porous this distinction between military life and life on the home front really was. I often, myself, create this artificial barrier between women who were with, quote-unquote, the army, and women who are on the home front. But really, even widows who were not traveling with the army were so connected to it. For example, with Phyllis, she asked a local storekeeper, a clerk, to write to Cuff asking him to come home and marry her. So she's like, let's work out your furlough. Let's figure out when you can, you know, get on leave. They were nearby. She was able to use his military service to secure her own marriage. And so this document really illuminates the ways that even women on the home front were drastically impacted by their connections to the military. I was also talking with a friend about this document the other day, and he mentioned, you know, it's kind of surprising to me to hear about Cuff liberating himself or gaining his freedom by serving for the Continental Army, because we both have read so much about individuals liberating themselves by taking advantage of Dunmore's proclamation and going to the British Army. So Dunmore was a governor who promised enslaved people if they could make it to the British Army and they were enslaved by patriots, they could be free if they served the army. We don't have this binary of, well, enslaved people could gain their freedom by going to the British, and that was the way they could gain their freedom. There's evidence of women who liberated themselves from slavery and they ran to the Continental Army to try to meet up with their husbands who were Black soldiers. In this case, we see Cuff deciding to enlist locally with the Continental Army. And so I think it also complicates the way we view loyalties, particularly enslaved people's loyalties during the American Revolution, to see that they were really assessing different options available to them.
That struck me as well. It seems like having an enslaved person in the army or a free Black person in the army might be like more of an exception. You like don't see that when you're watching movies about the American Revolution very often and things like that. And then also the fact that he was able to join and be the doctor, right? Like he's the person bringing these medical skills is just super cool and fascinating to me. And that everybody was like, this is a time of war. He knows how to mix drugs together. He's Dr. Cuff.
Yes. And we see that for women to some extent, too. There's a white woman whose pension application I've studied in depth, Sarah Benjamin. And she describes joining the army and she's washing and making bread and she's doing it alongside a Black woman named Letta. So Black women, too, would be sometimes teaching white women how to do certain tasks as well that were essential for the army. So I think it's really important what you just pointed out, that they're not in subservient roles they might be portrayed in film if Black individuals are portrayed in the military at all in the Continental Army. But in many instances, their leaders bringing their own knowledge to military lines.
So I just wanted to like briefly go on a slight tangent. There's been some discussion about Florida educational standards talking about slavery. And they've mentioned in Florida educational standards that they're going to bring up moments when a slave learned a skill during slavery that they were able to use to their own advantage after slavery. And I could see people very quickly using this as an example of that happening. But I just want to say quickly, the whole point of that argument is just a distraction from actually trying to look into the realities of the history of slavery. It's one of those things where it's like a gotcha. It's like, look, I can find this one guy who learned how to use a skill while he was enslaved at an apothecary. But the main question of slavery is so simple, which is that people should not be treated as property. And the fact that people were able to be competent human beings and turn things to their advantage should not be used as an argument that sea slavery isn't so bad. If Cuffy had been able to be a free person and get a medical degree on his own and be able to make money and live as a free person much earlier, wouldn't his life have been so much better instead of having to beg for literally every single thing? And that's the sort of central question about this to me.
Absolutely. And we also don't know what medical skills he had before he was enslaved as well. So what if he's bringing skills to this apothecary that the apothecary wouldn't have had before, similarly to the way he's bringing medical knowledge into the Continental Army camp? And the clerk frames it similarly to the way the Florida education system wants to frame it, as Cuff came to this apothecary and he was bestowed with this knowledge. Interestingly, Phyllis and Cuff's son, Prince Saunders, goes on to become a very important figure in his own right and an education minister of Haiti. But he was educated at Dartmouth, and in his obituary, it very conspicuously mentions it's because Phyllis's enslaver's son decided to bestow him with this Dartmouth education. It's the similar framing that overlooks knowledge that people like Cuff would have had and shared with others.
And in particular, you mentioned the Black women who maybe had joined as laundresses or nurses and things like that. It's not white women who own slaves don't know how to do these things because they're the people who are having enslaved people do all that for them. So, of course, the work that they're doing is incredibly valuable to the war effort. And to just see hard evidence of that in this document of her talking about this particular situation is just very satisfying to me. Phyllis just seems like a very talented person and convincing person. And it's so cool that her son went to Dartmouth and just continued being exceptional. We've talked a little bit about Phyllis outside of this letter. She mentions towards the end that she has no documentary evidence to back her story up. I've talked in an earlier episode about how hard it was for enslaved people to get documentary evidence for literally anything. In the South, enslaved marriages weren't seen as legal. You couldn't testify in court. You're basically removed from being able to be taken seriously as like a legal identity. And then because of that, the paper trail that historians and the people who are looking into these pension files would use just don't exist. So it makes it a lot easier to erase somebody. Do you find that coming up a lot in these pension files of women, poor women, women across classes, Black women, enslaved women? Is that something that you notice quite a bit?
It is, yes. And I have to admit, I laughed at this line in Phyllis's testimony. I have no documentary evidence except this certificate of my marriage that I asked somebody to create. Because that's more documentary evidence than most widows have. I'm thinking, Phyllis, you have evidence. Don't undermine your evidence. Many widows, yes, they would have a difficult time. So like Phyllis, they would sort of try to create their own evidence, particularly women who had been enslaved. Some would take Phyllis's approach. So she knew she was getting ready to submit this claim. And a couple of weeks earlier, in October of 1837, found a way to communicate with local reverends. Maybe she went in person. She also had a local clerk in one of her former enslaver's stores write for her sometimes. And she communicated with a reverend and even with the state comptroller saying, can you please send me a written paper that says you were here when I married my husband? Or in one case, it was the son of the minister. And she asked the comptroller, can you send whatever proof you have that my husband was paid for his service? Other Black widows in particular would ask for written evidence that there was no evidence. So one in particular who I'm thinking of, she received a piece of paper from the local church, and it said, well, we did not keep records of Black people's marriages between this years. There is no evidence. So she had created evidence from this silence and used this piece of paper as credible proof, which I also think says a lot about what the War Department believed was credible, that if you made silence into something tangible, signed by a leading man of the community, it could fill a silence that a woman's oral story would not be able to. So it's interesting. Other women would submit things like needlepoint samplers. So women were very creative in overcoming these silences, although it was difficult. And Phyllis had to confront that challenge for over 3 years before she succeeded.
That's crazy. You said 3 years of trying to get this pension. Does she get the money?
She does, but it was a very fraught process. And she almost did not get all of the money, but she continued to fight for what she believed she deserves. So the situation is this Act of 1836, right, requires that you married before your husband's term of service had expired. So Phyllis's husband, Cuff, enlisted in 1777. He was discharged in fall of 1783. They married in May of 1783, so that is before he stopped serving. But the War Department says, well, we don't have written evidence that he was paid after January of 1781. So how do we know that he was serving after 1781 and that you really married him after he was a soldier? So Phyllis has all of this oral testimony of men who swear that they had served alongside him, but because she doesn't have a payroll from 1783, they rule she does not qualify under this pension act. Another pension act was passed in 1838, and that allowed widows who married before, I believe it was 1794, to claim a pension for 5 years as opposed to life. And the person in charge of the War Department said, well, Phyllis clearly married before 1794, so why don't you apply under this? And she asked a local storekeeper who was helping her to reply, no, I qualify for a life pension and I am going to receive my life pension. She gets into a tricky situation because the only real strong oral testimony she can provide that her husband was still serving at the end of the war comes from a man who comes before the court and says, I know he was married to Phyllis before he stopped serving because he came and he gave me some camphor to smell, a type of medication. And Cuff made the comment to me, well, my wife Phyllis will be needing some of that soon too because she's going to be sick. She's going to be having a child. And I am going to marry her before that happens. And then he left to marry her. Well, Phyllis, until this point, had not told the court that she was pregnant before she was married, which wasn't by any means uncommon, but all of a sudden the court believes this is a blemish on her character. Her lawyer even makes the comment that she's a woman of very strong merit, except for during the instance I just mentioned, but it's understandable considering she'd been courting for 7 years. So she has to now overcome this prejudice. And I have to wonder if she knew she was going to face that, but believed it was the only way she could get pay. So she puts herself through this. But then the War Department decides, okay, maybe this is proof you married before your husband's term of service was up, but then you remarried to somebody else after he died, and your status as Anthony Tatton's widow supersedes and invalidates your status as Cuff Saunders's widow. And at this point, Phyllis is very distressed. She's indigent. She's furious with these excuses the War Department seems to be making up to deny her a pension. So she petitions Congress. She petitions the Committee of Claims in Congress and says, the War Department is not accepting my claim, but I deserve a pension for life. By this point, it's about 1840, and she finally receives a favorable report from the Committee of Claims in 1841 that she should receive a pension for life. But then Congress adjourns before they can go any further with it. In 1842, Congress decides that she, you know, again, she should receive a pension. Her petition comes back up. But now they've added that it should only be for 5 years, as the War Department had initially said. So Phyllis and her lawyer write back again, refusing, saying that she deserves a pension for life. And she finally received it in 1842. So about 5 years after she first applied.
The fact that these War Department ghouls are just sitting there judging this person when their whole job is deciding who deserves to get money is just so infuriating. Oh my God. No, I think you're right. That sounds completely reasonable that she might have avoided mentioning the fact that she was pregnant before she got married. But also the fact that enslaved people legally, that marriage didn't mean anything. The fact that she has to wait for her enslavers to give her permission to get married. All of that. It's just absolutely infuriating. Good on Phyllis for fighting it out, for sticking to her guns and just continuously fighting it. That is so fabulous. So this is a season about wit, which sometimes we have been talking about in terms of, you know, somebody writing something funny or using sort of language play. In this case, I think this is somebody who is using their wits to achieve a goal. The deck was stacked against her for this, to get this pension for a number of reasons. That she is able to, as a free Black woman, get all this together, get her team together, sort of strategize what she's going to say and when she's going to say it. What an incredible person.
Absolutely. And her ability to turn to all of these different types of evidence. I didn't mention she even submitted her son's obituary in a newspaper, which briefly mentioned, oh, he was the son of Phyllis and Cuff, saying, look, can you accept the newspaper as proof of my marriage? So she was constantly thinking of new ways to try to produce evidence, to find evidence, which is even more exceptional to me when I remember that she didn't know how to read or write. So she was really using her wit, especially socially, to draw upon her networks and connections that made it possible for her to navigate a complex political system, one that would have been complex for somebody who knew how to read and write.
What do you want people to get from this story?
I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is to look at somebody like Phyllis, a woman who'd been enslaved, a free Black woman, and to see that she was a political actor, someone who was not only aware of the political system around her and of her own political efficacy, her ability to advocate for her own interests locally and on a federal level, but that she was prepared to participate in that for such a prolonged period so tenaciously is very important. And the fact that Phyllis isn't an anomaly, I think, is important to take away, because it's easy to read a document like this and think, wow, how exceptional. The lawyer who was writing this pension file wrote that she was, quote, the most remarkable, intelligent, colored woman, end quote. So he's trying to portray her somehow as exceptional for a Black woman. And Phyllis is exceptional in the sense that she is incredibly intelligent, but she's not exceptional in the sense that she's an anomaly. There were many other Black women like Phyllis who had become free during the war and who were drawing upon their local networks to try to advocate for pension files, even as they were facing tremendous discrimination from the War Department. So to see that, I think, is really, really important, to see women as their own political advocates, particularly in an era like the 1830s and 40s when it's easy to focus on white abolitionists or white individuals who are advocating for Black rights, and to see how even illiterate women like Phyllis were able to be some of their own strongest voices.
That's such a great point. This is one of the stories that we know, but that doesn't necessarily mean that this was someone who was completely distinct and unique.
If anybody who's listening is really interested in these pension files and wants to read more, the National Archives has images of them all online, but they are not transcribed. So there are tens of thousands of files like Phyllis's out there just waiting to be discovered. And anyone can help transcribe them through the National Archives. They have this citizen archivist tool where anyone can go on and read these pictures and transcribe them, which means they're searchable. And you can find more women like Phyllis who are kind of disappeared into these difficult to navigate archives. So if anyone feels inclined to read some files like this on your own, or to maybe try your hand at transcribing and doing some of your own research, I would absolutely recommend looking at that tool on the National Archives' website.
That's awesome. That's so important. And as somebody that transcribes a lot of letters as my job for a long time, it's fun. It's worthwhile. It takes a little getting used to. But if you are looking for something, if you are bored on an evening and you're like, maybe I want to read a completely fascinating letter from 200 years ago, there's much worse ways to spend your time. Riley, this is such a fabulous conversation. I cannot wait to see the work that you do with all of this and with your future career. Anywhere you want to point people to?
I have a personal website that I post updates on, and it is linked to my Twitter, which is at RKJSutherland. So I'll be sure to post Phyllis's full pension file on there in case anybody wants to read more details about her life, any of the other depositions, as well as some updates about other Revolutionary War widows.
Fantastic. So I will link to your Twitter and we'll link to some of these resources in the show notes. For my listeners, thank you so much for listening. I am, as ever, your most obedient and humble servant. Thank you very much. Your Most Obedient and Humble Servant is a production of R2 Studios at the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media at George Mason University. I'm Catherine Garrett, the creator and host of this podcast. Jeanette Patrick and Jim Embusky are the executive producers. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to listen to past episodes and check out more great podcasts from R2 Studios. We tell unexpected stories based on the latest research to connect listeners with the past. So head to r2studios.org to start listening.